10 after 8, the House, almost said the wrong committee, the House State Affairs, let me check my card here. Okay, the House State Affairs Committee will come to order. This morning, we're going to be considering three bills, HB 166 involving contribution from permanent fund dividends, HB 151 indemnity clause in public contracts, and HB 92 jurisdiction of the ombudsman. And we're going to begin with HB 166. So the sponsor of that bill would come forward, we'll listen to what you have to say.
Good morning, Chairman Lynn, members of the committee. I'm Representative Thomas, District 5, and with me is my staff, Casey Schroeder-Hotch. We're here to present House Bill 166. House Bill 166 is an attempt to increase, I'm going to call it private contributions, because I'm like some people, contributions in Alaska by giving people an option of donating a portion of their permanent fund dividend check to their favorite charity. People have in the past, but they usually have two or three blocks in there, and you have to go through the legislative process to get on there. So this will shorten it up by allowing 501(c)s, threes that are qualified in Alaska, to be listed in a whole page. But anyway, one whole sheet. Alaskans who make $100,000 or more rank 49th or 50th in the nation as far as percentage of income donated to charities. Maybe we're just a little hungrier than most, but in the hustle and bustle of life, we often forget about those organizations who rely solely on donations and who provide important services to our communities. HB 166 allows for a list of approved organizations to be included with a person's permanent fund application and allows them to check off which charities they would like to donate to. 100% of their donations will go to the charity. The simplicity of being able to simply check the desired charity while applying for one's permanent fund dividend will increase the rate of donations and give these charities another avenue to use for their fundraising. HB 166 also requires that the charity meet certain criteria before it can be placed on the list with the permanent fund applications. Among the criteria, the charity must be a University of Alaska campus or provide vocational training or post-secondary education, provide a positive youth development program, workforce development, aid to the arts, or aid or services to individuals who are elderly, low-income, in emergency situations, disabled, or mentally ill. The Rasmussen Trust, who will, I believe is online or will be testifying later, is a charitable foundation which makes $25 million in grants each year to Alaska organizations, has pledged to fully fund the administrative costs of the program for the first 3 years of the program, creating a zero fiscal impact on the state in these crucial beginning years. HB 166 gives people a simple and convenient way to donate to their favorite charities who make a positive impact on our communities, and I urge your support in this important piece of legislation.
Thank you, appreciate that. I did have one question. If I were to make a contribution with a checkoff, would that be my entire dividend or no contribution, or maybe a percentage of the dividend?
Casey's got that. Yeah.
This is Casey Schroeder-Hotch, staff to Representative Thomas. The bill states that you can donate $25, $50, $75, or $100, or 10%, 25%, 50%, or 100% of your check. So you can decide how much you want to donate.
Good, that answers the question for me. Any questions? Representative Roses.
Do you have the cost of what they anticipate it's going to be for each year, for the first 3 years?
We have a fiscal note here. We have a fiscal note here from the Department of Revenue, and it's $320,000.
Oh, okay, it wasn't in my pack.
Yeah. Okay.
Do you then, if I may follow up, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Then after the first 3 years, will the administrative costs be taken out of the operation of the permanent fund, or will it then require a general fund note to cover the cost after 3 years?
It has to be the bill has to be reauthorized, and I'm not sure if Rasmussen will continue that. They're online, and they can answer that one.
Okay.
but this bill sunsets in 3 years.
Okay.
And I wanted to ask you, if I were to make a contribution with a checkoff, say for 50%, would I have a receipt to show our friends in the IRS?
Yes.
I say friends facetiously. Any other questions?
I'd like to see that.
Thank you very much. Oh, Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So you would be able to designate which charity it went to, or is it going to a pool and just split?
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, it's my understanding that they will review all the 501c3s that are eligible, and they'll be on a list when you get your application, so you can check it then. Not everyone in Alaska will be eligible, so they will. There's some guidelines that are in the what do you call it, the analysis paper that we have here. So they have to go be very well scrutinized, I guess you'd say. You have to have had filed an income tax forms with the IRS and stuff. So there'll be all the bad ones will be weeded out, and you'll have just honest charitable.
One more question, Mr.
Please.
And this, I don't know if this is directed to you, but in this, our fiscal note, it says that the 320 comes out of the general fund. And as I look at the fiscal note for the identical bill going through the Senate, the 320 comes out of statutory program receipts. So you, it may not even be your, that's something you can even address, but I just, that inconsistency, I was just wondering.
I'm sorry, I was talking.
In the Senate fiscal notes for an identical bill, it comes out of statutory program receipts, and out on our fiscal note, it comes out of GF. So I'm wondering what the, which it is, or, and that's probably not anything you can respond. I'm just wondering how we got two different fiscal notes from the same money coming from different places on the same bill. So
I noticed through the chair that revenue was here, and that I think they're on the sign up sheet too.
Okay. And I wanted to ask if I may, if I want to split my contribution to more than one charity, say two or three charities that I might like, can I do that on the same form?
Yes. It'll have all the big estimate is about 2,000 of them that you can check.
So Representative Grunberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have two areas of questioning. I appreciate, first of all, the Rasmussen Foundation's very generous offer. I have not seen that on a piece of legislation before, and I think that's excellent. It's really kind of a question for not only you, but the foundation if they're on the line, and that is whether they would mind if we put a clause in that this bill would be contingent upon the foundation entering into a contract with the state guaranteeing that they would pay those funds.
Excuse me, guaranteeing
what? That they would pay the administrative costs, so we have it in writing and it's a contract.
Like I said, they're on online.
They're going to be online.
Them. Yeah.
I have a couple of people here.
But I have one other question.
Right, thank you.
And that is something that really does concern me. And I support the legislation, but I have one concern, and I need to let you know what it is. On page 2, lines 20 through 28, it appears to me that only certain types of charities, 501c3 corporations or charities, would qualify. It looks to me, for example, that you couldn't give to a hospital like Providence Hospital, possibly couldn't give to a museum or a library. You couldn't give to private nonprofit K-12 schools, SPCAs, group like that, that are very legitimate 501c3 organizations. And I'm wondering if that was your intent, because normally for checkoffs, as long as an organization would qualify as a 501c3, that would be the donor's choice.
Our intent, or my understanding, is that if you're qualified 501c3, that you would qualify.
I was hoping you would say that. You need to really take a look at the language on page 2, lines 20 and 28, and I can certainly talk with you about it, but it's much narrower than any 501c3, and that does concern me a lot.
Would it be appropriate to put 501(c)(3) in here?
I think it would, but I would like to really make certain that the sponsor is absolutely in agreement with that, and I would certainly like to see
we'll
that.
We'll be talking to the Department of Revenue in just a couple of moments here.
Thank you.
Representative Roses.
Yes, a follow-up on that particular point. I think probably, and we'll find out when we have an opportunity to speak with the representatives from the Rasmussen Foundation, but I think probably if they're planning on paying for the implementation of this for the first 3 years, they probably are going to want some type of restriction on which type of 501(c) that they would allow into the program. Otherwise, you've got Friends of the Moose, Friends of the Wolves, you know, Friends of the Spruce Tree, the Birch Bark Beetle Society. I mean, any the, it
no
opens
friends
it up
the
to. Well, no, that's down here in the mentally ill part.
Yeah.
Yeah. Make a note of that.
So another Republican Democratic Party are covered. So. So I think that may be why the restriction is to the organizations that are here, is because the foundation probably doesn't want this opened up to just every 501(c), because they're expeditious in who they contribute funds to and who they don't. And now you're using their money to contribute to maybe some of the organizations that they would have no interest in supporting.
We'll check it out. Makes sense. Anything else? If not, thank you very much. Please stick around here. Is Jerry Burnett from the Department of Revenue available?
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee.
Good morning, sir. You're going to answer all of our questions, right?
I'll answer whatever questions you ask. By the way,
what's the capital of North Dakota?
That's a tough one. I haven't been in sixth grade for a long time, so okay. That's when we learned that.
Some of us know.
For the record, my name's Jerry Burnett. I'm the Director of Administrative Services, Department of Revenue.
Bismarck.
And I'd like to say a few words on this bill, and then I'll be happy to answer your question. Department of Revenue has no position on the legislation as it's written in terms of whether you want to do it. Charitable contributions, and what the use of permanent fund dividends is not our concern. Our concern is only administering the program and making sure that we efficiently get the money to the qualified Alaskans in a timely manner. We do have some concerns about the bill, and those concerns revolve around the complexity of having a wide variety of choices on the menu, that is dollar amounts and percentage amounts. Every time you add a choice, you add complexity in our payment system, you add complexity to the application, and people who are applying for permanent fund dividends, want a very simple application. If there's questions, they have to call us. And, it may seem a little bit, not much of a problem to you, but, if 10% of the people who apply want to access this program, and 10% of those have a question about it, that's 6,000 phone calls we're going to get someday. And, we have to have staff that can answer those phone calls. And we don't, we don't mind answering phone calls, but the more you get, and if they don't get to us, they're going to get to you. And then they're going to get someplace else. And
you might want to refer them back to you.
And then they're going to get to me. If they don't get our staff, they're going to get you or your staff, and then they're going to get me personally, not somebody else. So we do have concerns about complexity. We will work with the sponsor. We'll work with the Rasmussen Foundation if the bill moves forward on those issues. And then there may be unintended consequences working on this, where we do have people who have questions, and we may end up having more work or less work. I don't know. We've never done this before. The only checkoff we have at this point is for the University of Alaska Advanced Tuition Program. Hmm. And that is operated in a way where the people are identified with a list, we write one check to the university foundation, and they administer the program, apply the money to each of the people. So the more we can make it resemble that, the easier it will be to administer for the department.
So you accumulate the checkoffs and write one check?
Right. Essentially, send them a list and, you know, a data file and a set of money.
Representative Roses.
I think another possibility that I think may be an unintended consequence, having taught math for 20-something years, I can assure you there's a considerable number of people out there that really do not understand percentages. And that's why on a lot of your receipts in the restaurants now, they will actually print out what 10, 15, 20% is so that you don't have to figure it out. So one of my concerns is if somebody checks off a box for 50, thinking it's $50 when they've marked 50%, and then the minute their check comes and there's nothing left in their mind compared to somebody else, you know who they're going to be calling.
Right.
And so at that particular point, you're almost going to have a situation where there's an appeal process in the event that somebody says, wait a minute, I messed up. You know, I didn't mean 50% of the check. I only meant $50. I marked the wrong box. Well, at that point, it's probably too late. But I think the idea is great. I support it. But, again, it's all going to be on how the form is. And each year, since the value of the permanent fund dividend check varies, you know, it'd almost be impossible because at the time of the application, you don't know what the check's going to be. So you can't say, well, 50% would equal so that they have some idea. Because trust me, even if you spell it out, some of them aren't going to get it right. So those are some of my concerns. So I'm not sure that I like the $25, 25%, $50, 50%. The numbers are too. I mean, if there was a way to do it a little bit differently so that people clearly understood it, I think we would have less confusion.
We need to talk to education people about that.
Yes, I'm willing to tutor.
Okay, to the chair, Representative Roses, that's exactly the point that I was trying to make. And I would like to address the issue of the fiscal notes that Representative Johnson brought up. The House bill has a provision in it that prohibits the department from spending any permanent fund dividend money on it. And in the Senate bill, that provision was added before our fiscal note, or after our fiscal note was done. It's not clear to me whether or not this would be statutory designated program receipts or general fund program receipts. If, in fact, the bill requires a contract with the Rasmussen Foundation for them to pay it, it probably will be considered statutory designated program receipts. And that's a change that we're quite willing to work on with the Finance Committee and make sure that it gets budgeted correctly.
Any other questions? Representative Grunberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Burnett, if the Rasmussen Foundation and the sponsor are willing to have a clause in the bill that has a condition precedent for a contract, would the department be willing to help draft that contract?
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, I'm sure that we would work with them to do that.
Thanks.
Work with and draft two different things.
Well, that's, I mean, either way. It's
right.
I know. Any other questions?
Just a quick
one. Reverend Dahl.
How many people do you see yourself hiring, or how is this going to actually happen in terms of, you said it adds complexity for sure. It's going to take, of course, quite a bit of time to get this going, and that's provided in here, but what do you see in terms of personnel and so forth?
Through the chair, Representative Dahl, the biggest issue that we have to start would be rewriting the computer program. This is all going to be on an online application, and you know, approximately 75% of the people this year who are applying online. So it will be affecting most people. But the biggest thing will be contracting for computer support, making sure that the payment system works correctly to do this, and that the online application has all the parts. I think our fiscal note provides in the hundreds of thousands of dollars to do that. The other part, I think we're estimating maybe one additional person in the fiscal note. It's not a large number of people, but then it will have some effect spread throughout the division. And as I suggest, I think any time you add something new to a program that touches everybody in Alaska, we're going to get a lot of phone calls, we're going to get a lot of mail, you're going to get a lot of phone calls, and you're going to get a lot of mail about it, whether it works wonderfully or whether it works poorly. And we'll do everything we can, should this bill pass, to make it work as good as it can possibly work.
Any more? Okay. There's any roses.
Thank you. Again, I'm not trying to complicate the issue, but try to bring up questions that I think we may need some clarification on if this program passes. But what if you have a scenario where someone's permanent fund dividend is under garnishment and they check off 50% of their check to go to a charity because they say, hey, I'm gonna show this guy, or 100% of their check? What has priority when it comes to the department to determine who gets what? Is it who signed up first or who has the legal standing, or, you know, so?
To the chair, Representative Roses, there is an order of priority. And so, in fact, the garnishments would come first because they're court-ordered garnishments, and, you know, child support always comes first, and
I'm sure those collecting those funds appreciate that prioritization.
Okay.
I would think so. Representative Grunberg.
On exactly that point, through the chair, Mr. Burnett, would we not have to amend those statutes in the bill to indicate where in the priority order this would be?
To the chair, Representative Grunberg, I don't believe so, because this would not be a garnishment. This is a voluntary assignment. Voluntary assignments will always come after garnishments.
So, through the chair, the voluntary advanced tuition comes after garnishments, too.
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, that's correct.
Okay.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you very much. And I'm going to go by the order which people have signed up. Is Michelle Brown, United Way, here or online?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Yes. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, I'm Michelle Brown with United Way of Anchorage. Can you hear?
Hear you just fine.
Thank you, sir. I would like to say United Way of Anchorage strongly supports this legislation as both good social policy and, as a practical matter, an excellent way of promoting sustainability for the invaluable services of nonprofits. On the first point of social policy, as was mentioned by the bill sponsor, Alaskans have a great tradition of neighborliness and helpfulness, but that has not yet fully translated or been developed into a culture of philanthropy in a cash-based economy. And this is an excellent way to begin to educate Alaskans about the many options they have to further their interests in nonprofits through financial support. On the practical side, despite what many Alaskans want to believe, government can't do everything, and much of what has been done regarding quality of life comes from the work of nonprofit organizations and their volunteers. Specifically in United Way's area of health and social services, we are a network of organizations that care for children and seniors, connect people with health care services and information, provide workforce development, and ensure that people are housed and fed so they can get educated and work. These services fundamentally help shape the quality of life in our communities for everyone, from our most vulnerable to any one of us who at some point in our lives need support and assistance when we're ill, need after-school care for our kids, or any number of life's issues. Many of these issues also, when they affect individuals, have significant impact as well, financially and socially, on the community as a whole. So it really is important that we have a way to address many of these issues. This permanent fund dividend checkoff is an easy way for people to invest in that quality of life for themselves and their neighbors in a very cost-effective way. Finally, I just want to mention there has been some conversation about implementing the legislation, and I just would like you to know that United Way of Anchorage stands ready to help implement this legislation if the state and the Rasmussen Foundation wants us to. We have a long history of managing donor-designated fundraising. We currently manage 5 public sector campaigns on behalf of governmental entities, which are very similar to how this legislation is set up. With that experience and with the manageable number of nonprofits that will be eligible under this legislation, we could be up and running with the state to implement this as directed very quickly, and it would also be very efficient. So I thank you for this opportunity to testify and, again, say how strongly we support this legislation.
Thank you, and we appreciate the good work that United Way does.
Thank you, sir.
Any questions? Representative Grunberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Two questions. If you were to manage this, what would be the cost to the program?
We, after the state does its work, we would be working with the 4-acre group, and we had estimated the costs would be under $100,000.
And would this be part of the money that Rasmussen would be paying as well?
Yes, for the first 3 years.
And secondly, do you have the bill in front of you?
Yes.
Looking at page 2, lines 20 through 28, are there any organizations under your umbrella that would not qualify under that?
No, not under our umbrella. They would all qualify.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Any other questions? Thank you very much. Okay, next I'm going to go to the Rasmussen Foundation. Is Sammy Bukrifty there, and did I pronounce your name correctly?
They just dropped off line.
Beg your pardon?
They just dropped off line. He's not online anymore.
Good. Maybe she is, but I've mispronounced the name.
No, they just dropped off.
Are they going to come back online?
Both of them off?
I'll let you know. Wait,
I have
it.
Are they both off?
No.
How about the next one?
Diane Kaplan's there.
Diane Kaplan.
Is Diane Kaplan there? They're both off, right?
No, she's there.
Okay.
Oh, I'm here.
And then...
this is Diane Kaplan.
Hi, Diane.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing good. Yeah. Excuse me, is Sammy going to be coming back on, or is she...
Sammy is here with me, but I'm going to testify for us, but she's here as well.
Fine, thank you. Please continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We are very pleased to work with the state of Alaska on this initiative. This idea came about a couple of years ago. We were very aware of the data that was presented early about the relatively low level of giving, particularly among Alaskans who have enjoyed the benefits of living in our state for a long time. As you probably know, United Way does a wonderful job of making it easy for people to contribute, but United Way only reaches a few communities in our state, the major communities. The rest of Alaska does not have that type of workplace giving available to them. Because of the success of the state share campaign, the combined federal campaign, and other programs like that that make it relatively easy for people to participate, and also provides them with a list of organizations that they can be sure are well-managed, that file financial data, that they can trust will spend their money well. We think this will be a terrific way of advancing interests around promoting philanthropy in our state. We know our state has a very long history of being generous in terms of people helping people. And this will be a way to help organizations that we have come to depend on deliver critical services around the state. The dollars that are given by individuals are the most precious to organizations. When an organization gets a grant from the state or the federal government, it's tied to a particular program, and the dollars that are really most valuable are the ones that can be used when the boiler breaks, when the roof needs to be fixed, when there's a client who has an emergency and there's no particular state grant, federal grant to cover it, but it's still a very real need. And those are where individual dollars can be particularly beneficial in Alaska. Also, these dollars are used to leverage other sources of support. Giving you an example, in the case of public broadcasting, as you've probably heard many times, every dollar that they receive in contributed income is used to leverage additional federal dollars. And that's true for many organizations in other fields. So we are committed. Our board has made available funds for the first 3 years of the program. In talking with the division, they wanted to keep this as simple and low cost as possible, and we agree. And because of United Way's long history of working with the state on administering donated dollars through the state share campaign, it was thought that they could be the correct contractor to work with the state, and that way the state could electronically determine where individuals have designated their dollars, write a single check to the United Way, and then it would be United Way's responsibility to distribute those funds, making it very, very simple for the state and keeping the administration as low as possible. So we appreciate very much this opportunity to testify, Mr. Chairman. I'm happy to answer any questions you have.
I thank you, and we appreciate the Rasmussen Foundation. Representative Rosas.
Yes, I don't know if you were online earlier and you heard the conversations regarding the restrictions that are in the bill in terms of the type of 501(c)s that were there, and there was a comment made on maybe we should open it up and just simply put 501(c). Would you still be interested in sponsoring and the administrative costs on this if it were opened up to all 501(c)s, or are you only interested in those that are specified in this bill?
You know, there are about 6,000 501(c)(3)s in Alaska, and the main issue in limiting the number is if you had 6,000 choices on the permanent fund dividend, we think the program wouldn't be very effective for any of them. So we were looking for a way both to make this program rational in terms of providing real support for core service providers, but also making sure the organizations that are listed have credibility with the public. And so that's really more the limiting factor to get it down to the current several hundred would be you have to file an annual tax return with the IRS, you have to have an audit, you have to already be engaged in individual fundraising, you have to have a certain budget and staffing and so on, and you have to have been tax exempt for a period of time, have a voluntary board of directors who are resident here in the state. So all of these things are really the major limiting factors. The Rasmussen Foundation funds in every area of life, so we don't have any particular interest in limiting to this or that organization. I think originally when this bill was introduced, it specified only youth programs, and it's been dramatically expanded to try and anticipate many different organizations. So I think it is pretty broad at this point, but we don't have any particular interest in limitation in that way. Our interest in limitation is more around organizations that can demonstrate a certain level of professionalism so the public can have confidence in the program.
So then the question that was brought up earlier regarding the friends of the legislators or the Republican, the Democratic Party, they probably would then not pass that high level of credibility with the public?
Only because they probably fall under a different section of the IRS code. They would probably be a 501(c)(6) or other type of organization and would not fall under this legislation because they're involved in political activities and other sorts of things. So this is specific to organizations that are public charities whose sole mission is serving the public, as opposed to individual members or other groups of people.
I appreciate that, and the intent of the comment was one of humor, but the other was also to get it on the record that people very clearly understood what type of charity we're talking about. So I appreciate your indulgence on my attempt at humor.
That was just an expression of monopartisanism.
Monopartisanism.
Through the chair, Representative Rosas?
Yes.
I understand from Sammy you were a great math teacher, and we could count on your information about percentages fully.
That's correct, and any tutoring services that are at free of charge for those that don't know the difference.
Raising campaign funds here.
No, I said free.
Representative Dahl.
Yeah, thank you. You know, this is sort of more of a sort of statement of concern than a question, because I do believe that the problem here is going to be how one selects the charities that receive this, and there will be some discriminatory measures. I worked for a period of time, for a short period of time, for United Way, and went to various agencies and so forth to have people sign up for the United Way deductions. And I know that there are many, 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 many different kinds of groups listed on that, and many of them will not be on this list. And I'm just a little bit concerned that there could be some problems with that. Any thoughts about that? Do you anticipate anything like that?
That's when she's done.
Through the chair, we think that the issue for organizations qualifying is probably going to be around the specific criteria that are laid out in the bill. If you look at a term like organizations serving low-income individuals, Most 501c3s in our state in some way serve low-income individuals as a focus. If you look at the arts, that will cover public broadcasting, museums, libraries. The process that Michelle Brown described involving the 4-Acre Group and United Way in looking at any situations where an organization might be in a gray area will involve a statewide group representative of all the different nonprofit sectors, all the way from the university to hospice to arts groups. On that board, from the Juneau area, there are at least 2 or 3 nonprofit representatives from different fields, arts and the women's shelter, and from the United Way as well. So we're pretty confident that every organization that can meet the basic criteria is going to get a fair shake being included.
Any follow-up?
No, thank you.
Thank you. Representative Grunberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Kaplan.
I'm hoping for that, but it hasn't happened yet.
I won't tell your husband.
Representative Grunberg got his tongue tangled up.
My only concern, Diane, was with the language, specific language on lines 20 to 28. The criteria on the rest of the bill, bottom of page 2, all the way down to line 23 on page 3, I don't have any problem with. I want to be sure that that legitimate organizations that are 501c3s and would meet those criteria would qualify under the bill. I see, really looking at, do you have the bill in front of you?
Yes, I do.
Okay. The United Way deals with the kinds of organizations described on page 2, lines 22 through 28. My first question is whether the United Way also deals with those who are in the first sentence in subsection C, vocational training or post-secondary education. Are those organizations also under United Way?
Talking about United Way, Representative Grunberg, through the chair, they would simply be the contractor that would ensure that the organizations who receive designations from members of the Alaska public would receive those dollars. They would be providing the technical services. There would be no requirement whatsoever that an organization be a United Way organization to be part of this program. United Way would simply be the contractor to receive the funds from the state and then redistribute them, make sure that donors receive a receipt showing that they made a charitable deduction, so on. They would be putting no opinion on the type of organization that was receiving the funds.
That's
been anticipated.
The reason, through the chair, I was focusing, this is sort of a different line of questioning, on the first several words of page 2, line 22, vocational training or post-secondary ed, there are lots of little, and I don't mean any aspersions here, maybe barber colleges or things on the back of a matchbook or something that aren't accredited or anything like that, that could be considered voc training, post-secondary ed, wouldn't be 501c3 at all, and as a matter of fact, might even this bill could be used as a way of helping pay somebody's tuition or something like that. What kind of controls would there be on these organizations who wouldn't qualify, like for student loans? They have to be qualified for student loans under the Student Loan Corporation. They have to meet certain qualifications. How would that be handled?
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, the entity receiving the funds would have to be a 501c3 nonprofit corporation, so a for-profit company, regardless of whether it provided educational services or any other services, could not be a recipient of these dollars. And the reason is public would expect to get a tax deduction for making the donation, and those entities are not tax exempt. Further, individuals also cannot be recipients of dollars because, again, it would not then be tax exempt for the donor. So this is certainly not the only way that individuals can contribute for those types of activities, whether it's scholarships for individuals or to for-profit vocational training entities. But under this particular law, you would have to be non-profit corporation to receive funds.
And finally, if
Reverend Greenberg.
I don't know if you heard my previous questions, whether the Rasmussen Foundation would have an objection to putting a provision in the bill that would make this contingent upon the state entering into a contract with the Rasmussen Foundation, that the Rasmussen Foundation would pay the administrative costs. What the sponsor has said in the sponsor's statement is the Rasmussen Foundation, a charitable foundation which makes $25 million in grants each year to Alaska organizations, has pledged to fully fund the administrative costs of the program for the first 3 years of the program, creating a zero fiscal impact on the state in these crucial beginning years. Would the foundation be willing to enter into a written agreement to that effect?
Through the chair, Representative Greenberg, absolutely we would.
Thank you.
Thank you. Good question. Representative Rogers, then Representative Cogburn.
Thank you very much. On page 2, and speaking at, again in those lines 20 through 28, on line 22 it mentions vocational training, and on line 25 it mentions workforce development. So would you envision that any of the apprenticeship programs under the umbrellas of the various labor unions would also then qualify under this definition?
Through the chair, Representative Rosas, I'm not specifically familiar with how those are set up in terms of their tax status, but I know, for example, Alaska Work Partnership, which is the provider of those services for many of the labor unions, is definitely an eligible entity in terms of our funding, and I know that they are a 501c3. So I think there's usually a nonprofit provider involved. But in terms of the specifics of the question you just asked, I hesitate to answer because I'm not that specifically familiar with their governance structure.
And I appreciate your comment. I was hoping, I have the same, you know, foggy memory of that as well. I was hoping you had a little more information to provide and fill in the gaps that I had. So you and I are both about situated the same on that piece. I have as many questions now as I had before.
Representative Cogill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Diane, first of all, thank you for the work that you and the Rasmussen Foundation have done to date. And it looks like a good idea to me, but there are several things that I struggle with. And when we get to debating the committee, whether we should vote it out or not, I'll probably bring those up. But turn the bill to page 3, line 15, and just a question. If you help put this criteria together, maybe you could help explain $100,000 or 5% of its total receipts, whichever is less, from contributions. Is that intended to be individual or private contributions?
Through the chair, Representative Coghill, that would be from any source of contributed income. And the rationale behind that is there are some organizations that are 100% funded, let's say, by Medicaid or Medicare. They're not really involved in raising funds from the public. And those would be organizations that probably
type of legislation.
So we're looking at organizations who are actually in the practice of receiving and requesting donations from the public. That was the intent.
Okay. That answers my question. Then the other question is just for the edification of myself and maybe others listening in, on page 3, line 22 and 23, 501c4 and 6, those could you help me understand the type of tax structure that is?
In terms of 501c4, 501c6, those are generally organizations that either under C4 are involved in lobbying activities, and they are actually allowed under their tax status to lobby an unlimited amount, but as a result of that, they are not tax exempt. If you or I were to write a contribution to a 501c4, we can't deduct it from our taxes. So they're nonprofit for other purposes, probably in terms of paying property taxes and things like that, but individuals cannot donate to them and take a tax deduction. 501c6s are usually organizations that primarily serve their members. That would be like a chamber of commerce or an organization like that, a Rotary Club, where the specific purposes are to benefit a specific group of people rather than the public at large. However, some of those organizations, like Rotary, set up Rotary Foundations. North Pole would be a perfect example. And they have a Rotary Foundation that is a 501c3, and it does specifically charitable work. So those types of organizations who are membership groups but are very involved in public benefit activities often have a sister 501c3 organization that they do raise tax-deductible funds from.
Okay, and Mr. Chairman, also your work with the 4-Acre Group has been a huge benefit to Alaska with the 501c3 groups, and so I wanted to make sure that that was mentioned. In putting together this language, so the criteria that you've got lined out shows that you want to make sure that they're credible, and I greatly appreciate that. But because of that, your parameters are going to probably put some on the what you'd call a preferred giving list, and there are going to be there's going to be now a tension, I think, between those who are on the check off list and those who are going to be competing. And do you anticipate, or have you talked about a tension that might arise publicly on that type of issue?
Thank you, through the chair, Representative Coghill. We're really looking at this as a rising tide and all ships benefiting down the road, because our hope is to really do a very extensive public campaign about individual giving. Some people will choose to give through their permanent fund, and I think other people will choose to give in another manner. If people have their awareness raised about individual giving, if their particular group of choice is not on this list, they still have every right to take $25 or $100 from their permanent fund and give it to that organization. They just might not be doing it through the checkoff. So we really believe, our hope is just to raise the awareness around charitable giving for individuals in general, and we see the permanent fund dividend as just one of many tools to do that.
But that does give some of an advantage to those on the checkoff list. Is that correct?
Through the chair, yes. It would, but I think our estimate is there'll be about 600 organizations from all around the state who will make it onto that list. So I think, whereas there have been some states that have done this type of checkoff in states that have an income tax, and it's, you know, it might be a group of 6 or 8 or 10 groups. I think this really provides the public with a very, very wide choice. And any organization that wishes to qualify need only follow these criteria, which are pretty standard best practices governance criteria for nonprofits. So I think many, many organizations and ultimately individuals around the state will qualify. Are the criteria perfect? Probably not, but I think this was the best list that a group of very experienced nonprofit executives and donors from around the state could come up with to get the number to one that the sponsors and the Permanent Fund Division thought was feasible.
Thank you, Representative Dahl.
Yes, thanks, Diane. I understand that there has to be criteria, but I noticed that there's nothing here about children. And it seems to be particularly, as you say, here for post-secondary, vocational, seniors, so forth. Can you speak a little bit to that? What about people who are 6 years old or 7, something like that?
Absolutely. Through the chair, Representative Dahl. If you look on page 1, line 25, there's a term youth development programs, and that's a very broad description for children serving organizations. That's the intent.
Page 2.
Yes, that's nice.
Representative Coghill, did you have a question?
No. Thanks.
Representative Grunberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Kaplan, I see on page 3, line 2 and 3, exempt from taxation under 501c3, quote, on the date of the application. That is the only criterion that sets a date for determination on any of the criterion. And my question is, should there not be something else in here that requires the organization to notify the manager if they no longer meet any of the nine criteria?
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, I think you make a good point, and I don't think we'd have any objection to that.
Did we make a note of that? Okay. Any other questions for her? I'd like to thank you very much. Anybody else on the line would like to testify?
Thank you.
Anybody in the audience would like to testify?
Excuse me.
Whoops. Representative Grunberg, you can testify, are you?
Not on this one.
Okay.
I think it might be helpful. I don't know if other people would be interested. I would like to at least see or have access. Is there any place we could see the list of the organizations or something, get an idea of what we're talking about here?
Are you still there?
Yes, through the chair, Representative Grunberg. There is a list. I believe you could access it. We could have Michelle Brown make it available.
Yeah, I would appreciate if they would do that through the staff here. The
I would like to see that, maybe get that to the chair and other members of the committee. Yeah. Representative Rosers.
Thank you. And in regards to that list, I think that would be helpful, but I would not want to see us hold this bill up in this committee while we're waiting up for a list. I would have confidence in the three members that are on this committee that also sit on Finance Committee to take a look at that on our behalf. So
no one's on Finance.
Nope. Through the chair, Representative Rosas, we agree. We're really anxious to try and see this go through this year and not have it delayed another year, because that's a big loss of income to the nonprofit.
Well, thank you. If nobody else?
There's no public corrected.
Testimony?
We should have somebody on Finance.
Usually those on Finance don't sit on any other committees.
Mr. Chairman.
Reverend Coghill.
The sponsor of this bill sits on Finance.
Very good. But he's not on this committee.
That's the fox and the chicken house problem.
Any discussion from the committee here? Mr. Representative Coghill.
Mr. Chairman, I appreciate Mr. Grunberg's suggestion that we amend it to somehow protect the nine criteria. However, I'm just going to make a broad and general statement. I like the idea, but I'm not in favor of the bill. And the reason is once you begin down the road of checkoffs, like we've already begun on the permanent fund, then it's just another me too. I am greatly appreciative of the Rasmussen Foundation, their offer, and their desire to get charitable giving revved up in Alaska. I'm just not sure this is the best way to do it. And I'm saying that almost to my peril, because I've looked at the Rasmussen Foundation for some help in other areas. But once you begin an application process that becomes so complex, then you start a little different dynamic on how people not only apply for the dividend, but the kind of the focus groups that begin to talk to people who get a dividend. Right now, we are going to say, we'll start writing checks for you. You just check them off. And we'll accept some of the responsibility for managing that. And I understand that people do a lot of advertising campaign, whether it's buying snow machines or cars around dividend time. But and this is still an individual choice, but we have chosen, and the Rasmussen Foundation stepped up to manage that, and so if you talk about individual initiative, the initiative is that I'm going to let somebody else manage the way I write checks, and I'm just not a big fan of turning the permanent fund dividend people into that type of management situation. Going to the college fund was something that I struggled with. It got through. This is a whole new program that would be attached to the permanent fund. And it, once again, I think accepting that responsibility needs to be thought through very carefully, because once you start accepting that responsibility, then there's other steps of responsibility that we'll pick up for people. And I understand the need for charitable giving, both in education and many, many other areas. I'm just not too sure this management program is the way to go.
Okay. Any other comment? Representative Rogers.
Thank you. I don't disagree with the comments that Representative Coghill has made, but we just recently closed out our budgets in Health and Social Services committee, subcommittee that I sit on, and there were a number of entities in there that would qualify for some of these funds. And some of the questions that we asked were, what kind of contributions to get? Do you have something where you can have the matching grants? And so we were looking very seriously at how do we leverage individual contributors' dollars and try to match that with state dollars as we're looking at areas to cut. And one in particular was some of the faith-based programs that are providing behavioral health programs and services. And one of the areas that we looked at there was, well, maybe we can cut this money out because they have the opportunity to raise funds somewhere else. And I think this becomes one of those opportunities. So from the standpoint of knowing that in the very near future, we're going to have to take a serious look at as oil revenues decline and the amount of money that people come and ask the state to contribute to make up for the federal declining dollars, I think if we can try to start leveraging some of the ways in which to get private funds into this, that's probably our only saving grace in terms of keeping some of those programs afloat. So even though I agree with Representative Coghill's statements in terms of complicating the issue, I also have a very great concern as to where we're going to go in the future in terms of making up those shortfalls that we're obviously going to have.
Reverend Grinberg.
Two things, Mr. Chair. One, I am somewhat concerned if the net result of this bill will not be to help the charities, but to let the state off the hook. Because I don't think this bill is designed to let the state off the hook.
Could you explain that a little better to me?
Yeah. What Representative Roses was saying was that if Charity A got money from a private source, then the state would defund it. And so the charity would retain no more money than it's getting now. And the beneficiary of this would be the state of Alaska. And there's no protection in the bill for that. I would like to see the charities benefit, not the state of Alaska. And there might be that we could put some language in this bill that would try to prevent that from happening. I want to benefit the charities, not just let us off the hook. That's number one. Number two, and if I could ask one question to Michelle Brown, could I ask another question to her?
In just a moment. But it's okay to benefit the state. There's nothing wrong with benefiting the state, because when push comes to shove, it's the responsibility of the citizens to support all the good causes in the world. It's not the state's job to help fund every 501c3 out there, all 6,000 of them in Alaska.
May I respond to that?
Yes.
We've talked about transparency, and that was a term I really wasn't familiar with until we started using it in this committee. But what this is designed to do is to increase citizen gift giving. And if the citizen knows that the money, the small amount of money they're giving to the charity, may simply go to reduce the money the state gives the charity, that's something that the citizen has a right to know. Just like what Representative Roses said a few minutes ago, that people get confused, $50 versus 50%, the dollar sign versus the percent sign. I think that most people, most Alaskans, wouldn't carry the reasoning
as far as Representative Rose's has, and they would think that their money's actually going to benefit the charity and not just going to reduce the state funding of that charity.
Would there be those who are not on this list, would those 501c3, would they be hurt? That there's some good groups out there.
That was my second question, Mr. Chair.
I'm learning to anticipate.
Could we get Michelle on the phone for one more question? I want to ask her what's not on their list. What wouldn't meet these criteria?
About 5,000 are not on there. Let me go to Representative Rose's first, and then
I just wanted to respond to Representative Gruenberg's remarks about how he thinks we should write something in there where the state won't benefit. If I led you to believe through my comments that's what we're looking for as a way to supplant some of the funds that the state is providing, that isn't what I intended to say. The point I was trying to make was when we were looking at potentials for cuts, when we were looking at the Health and Social Services budget, I mean, we were looking for $38 million worth of cuts. The areas that we were most cognizant of not trying to apply cuts were ones that had matching dollars. Because when you cut $1 there, you're actually cutting two. So those areas that are able to have the matching grants are the ones that fared the best in the budget, because we were very cognizant of the fact that you cut a dollar there, you lose two. And for every $2 you lose in services, you know, it has a great impact on what's happening with the individuals. The one area where we did look at that, and I mentioned the faith-based programs, and after we had the discussions and realized what was going on, that area didn't get cut. But, you know, that wasn't the intent of the comments that I made. The comments I was making was more along the line of where are we getting contributions from the private sector, and how can we better leverage the dollars to accomplish our objectives. And many of the grants that we're looking at now, that some of those areas have an evaluation and a rating system in terms of how they're performing and what they're doing, I think a lot of this will contribute to that. And so we're trying to direct the dollars to the areas that are having the best benefit and cutting only those that aren't providing the best benefit or getting the bang for the buck. So it's a very complicated program. But part of what I was trying to make is that as we move forward, whether it's the intention of the state to say, okay, well, they're getting private money, so therefore we don't need to give them any more money, we're going to have to start cutting regardless of where the money comes from or who gets it if the oil revenues continue to decline, which we know they're going to. So all I'm saying is that the charitable contributions are going to be much more important in the future than they are now, because there is going to be less state dollars regardless. And I don't care whether you think that we're trying to support the state. Fact of the matter is we're trying to support the organization, because there are going to be some shortfalls both from the federal government and the state government in the future. So from that standpoint, that's why I will support the bill, even though I share Representative Coghill's concerns about opening the door and where does it end. You know, once you let the horses out of the barn, it's difficult to corral them back in again. So that was the point I was trying to make.
Representative Rose, did you have a comment?
That's Johnson.
John Johnson. Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate your sentiments, but I don't think there's anything we could do to this bill that protects the charities that wouldn't encumber future legislatures and be unconstitutional. I just don't think that.
No, Mr. Chair.
Would you state the last part again, please?
That I don't think there's anything that we could do in this bill that would quote unquote protect the charities that wouldn't encumber future bodies and therefore be either unconstitutional or statutory. I don't know where it lies, but we can't encumber a future body and tell them what they have to do in the future. So we couldn't do anything, in my opinion, that would address that.
That's almost any bill that we consider here, right?
Well, not financially. We can't encumber a future. Financially, we can, and I think that's what we're looking at doing.
Do you respond to
that? Yeah, that obviously you're correct. To Chair Representative Johnson, I was just thinking of the intent here, not that we could do it. And Representative Rose is, I've never sat on the HESS Finance Subcommittee, and I don't know all the details. I just didn't want this bill to be used as an excuse to cut the charity, and that was it.
Sure. You have any, Don?
Yes, I'm going to support this bill. I see this a little bit like a voluntary tax that people are paying back to the only this, in this particular instance, they're giving it to their to the area which they would like to help, and rather than a general where it just goes to the state and you hope that it goes there, that's going to be beneficial. So I see this as a good opportunity to help areas of need.
Reverend Cargo.
It's kind of interesting that it'd be thought of as a tax, but the fact is, in any charitable organization, you tax yourself to get something done. So, but what's going to happen under this scenario is these are going to be kind of the preferred group. And so what you have then is at the top of the list, you have the University of Alaska, you have educational organizations and community foundations that generally enjoy a lot of support from the state. So I just struggle. What happens is you're going to set up this kind of interesting dialogue where all the rest of us who are charitable organizations become kind of the second class ones. And so you could, and I'm not saying that that was the intent of this, but it could have that stratification that I struggle with. Notwithstanding that, now we're going to put in a list of what the state thinks is charitable. I understand Ms. Kaplan's desire to kind of squeeze it because you can't put everybody on there. But by doing that, what you do is kind of have this preferred list, and I can see a tension arising. Some of these people have the ability to advertise outside of this particular budget
because
type
they
thing.
Have money to advertise.
Well, the University of Alaska has been doing a lot of advertising over the last few years, a lot of advertising, and probably for good reason. I know the need for charitable giving. I know the need for education issues, and I'm greatly appreciative of it. I just wonder if it becomes our responsibility to do the collection and distribution. And I just can't get there.
Okay. You have a comment from the committee? So we get Representative Gernberg, then we have to make some decisions here.
Yeah. I have some of the same concerns as Representative Coghill. I just would like to know if there, and I'd ask Ms. Kaplan or Ms. Brown, if I could, through the chair, are there any recognized charitable organizations or groups that do not meet the criteria on page 2, lines 22 to 28, that would be legitimate charities? I don't want to eliminate them. I'm just wondering if either of them could tell me, are there any kinds of charities that are legitimate that don't?
And that was to
either one of them.
Or Michelle Brown?
Yes, sir, either one.
And I have a question for Michelle, maybe I can piggyback on that. I know on United Way there are a lot of organizations that I would like to give to that I don't find on your on United Fund. We got six, there's not 6,000 choices for United Fund. Michelle Brown, are you still with us?
Yes.
Can you respond to that? And maybe Diane Kaplan could jump in after you're done.
Okay, thank you. Through the chair, as Diane mentioned, United Way's role in this will be simply a pass-through contractor. So, for instance, we have, in our private campaign, we have 49 service partners that are affiliated with us, but you can also designate other health and social service providers. But this has nothing to do with our private campaign. This is more like administering this would be more like when we administer the SHARE campaign or the combined federal campaign, where the governmental entities determine who's eligible, and we then simply do the administrative work. So it really doesn't tie in any way, shape, or form with the United Way private campaign. And so, for instance, the combined federal campaign, there are thousands of organizations that are qualified by the federal government to participate, and our role is to run the campaign and then pass the funds to those organizations who are designated by donors.
Thank you. And who will decide who qualified and who does not qualify, which particular charities? Did I ask that correctly?
Yes.
Yes, do you want me to answer that, or Diane, did you want to answer?
Anybody can answer it.
No, go ahead, Michelle.
We have set up with the 4-Acre Group and with Rasmussen, and as Diane mentioned, a panel of advisors, a process by which organizations will apply, and then there will be a review process with a number of checks and balances. There'll be initial review, then there'll be a supervisor review, and any time there is a decision that somebody would not be eligible, it will go to this broad statewide panel for a third level of review. In this process, we had determined it would be a very liberal interpretation of the language criteria that Representative Grunberg was citing on page 2, between in section C, where we expect most of the limitations where people will not qualify will be in the other issues. For instance, they will not have a voluntary board, or they won't have a board that resides in state, or they will have been too new to have been providing services for 2 years, or some other factor like that.
Would a particular charity, 501c3, social views have anything to do with whether it would qualify or not?
No, sir.
Johnson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Michelle, I'm wondering how many of the members, if someone has, will you have a checkoff box, I guess is the first question. It's kind of a 2 or 3 part question. Will there be a checkoff box for United Way?
I believe United Way would qualify, but we would also have to file an application and go through the same process.
And how many organizations did you say was under your umbrella?
We have 49 service partners.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One follow-up. Do you anticipate any of the 54, 5,500 charities that are not eligible under this to be coming to try to get under your umbrella?
Well, we're only in Anchorage, and we're only health and social services. And we always have people trying to get under our umbrella.
So is that a yes or a no?
We frequently have people want to join into our umbrella. And our funding goes to our service partners, but as we work on particular issues, it can also go broader than that.
Okay.
Fine, thank you.
One more.
One more, okay.
Can you tell me the administrative cost as a percentage of United Way?
When someone designates to a particular organization, we charge 8% for that. On the public campaigns, however, those run more at 2% or 3%.
Through the chair, this is Diane Kaplan. However, on the permanent fund program as proposed, 100% of the donation will go directly to the designated charity because the Rasmussen Foundation would be covering those costs.
Thank you. That,
okay, thank you.
That helps. Okay. Reverend Gerber, were you interested in offering an amendment at this point, or we want to hold off? What's your desire?
Okay.
Amendments are concerned.
There are several things here. This has been, I support the bill, but I want to be sure, since this is the only substantive, I mean, as opposed to the Finance Committee that is going to look, doesn't go to Judiciary anyplace. My concerns are I'd like to have something in the bill that will require there be a contract between the state and the Rasmussen Foundation that they will pick up the administrative costs. That should be a condition precedent. And secondly, that there should be a provision in there that the charity must notify the organization that's managing this if they are no longer eligible, no longer meet one or more of the eligible criteria. It sounds to me like from
what Ms. Brown said, Mr. Chair, that they have worked out a very structured procedure that's very fair to ensure whether an applicant meets the criteria, and there would be an appeal process in there. And I don't know if that has to be referenced in the bill. I don't want somebody just, as this goes on, ad hocking and kicking people out with no appeal or anything. It sounds like that's really worked out. But those two things on the contract and the eligible criteria, I think we should put those things in the bill.
With the concurrence of the committee, it might be wise to hold, members of the committee work with the sponsor on this, any particular amendments that might be appropriate, and also to discuss some of our personal concerns with the sponsors and others. If that's all right with the committee, I'm going to hold the bill at this point. I think it has some good potential, but we do have to be very, very careful on this. So thank you very much, and I appreciate everybody who's testified, and thank you so much. And please, I have another question to comment from Representative Roses.
No, just to comment, I will be leaving tomorrow afternoon to go to Chicago for a NCSL conference that I've been asked to attend. So if this comes up at the next meeting, I will not be here to vote on this in terms of passing it out, but I certainly want to encourage the rest of you, when we make these amendments, to clarify some things there. I want you to know that I'm very supportive of this moving forward.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Grunberg.
Representative Roses, through the chair, if there are some things you're specifically interested in, and you contact me in my office, Deneen Tuck, who's back there, we'll be happy to make certain that your views are incorporated.
Appreciate that.
You're going to Chicago in the middle of the winter from Alaska.
Hey, I was asked to go. I'm not going to, when the speaker asks, you don't say no.
I'll verify that. Thank you very much. With that, let's go to HB 151, Indemnity Clauses and Public Contracts.
May I, Mr. Chair?
Oh, yeah.
Could we take just one
minute? Yes, we'll take a card at it. House of State Affairs Committee, come back to order, please. We'll now consider HB 151, sponsored by Representative Johnson by request. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and it is humbling to sit before the committee. I appreciate it. A little bit of background. 151 basically is a bill that removes a hold harmless clause from contracts with the state. I want to start with kind of how this came about. It was called to my attention by a constituent, and we were having coffee at Fred Meyer, and he basically said, I didn't quite get a handle on it, so he's going to try to draw it in a picture for me. So he said, let's assume this is a state building, and someone slips on the ice out there and hurts themselves. And they get an attorney, and they start a lawsuit, and someone just makes an offhand comment, well, it was designed wrong, or the ice wouldn't have fallen on the sidewalk.
I think we got it.
The liability for that and the necessity to defend the state goes all the way back to the engineer that designed the building. Irregardless if someone didn't scrape the ice, irregardless if the contractor may or may not have done something wrong or put a flange on it, if someone just merely suggests it's clearly a design flaw, there wouldn't have been ice on the sidewalk. The designer and the engineer is responsible under some of the contracts of the state for defending the state and all of the legal costs involved. He may win the case, but it still doesn't take his time, his effort, and his legal expense are non-recoverable. What this bill does basically, it levels the playing field for all contracts of the state. It also ensures accountability. The person who didn't scrape the ice would be responsible, and it wouldn't go all the way back to the designer. The result of having some of these hold harmless clauses in some of our contracts is that it drives off some of the people. They just won't bid on it. It's very difficult to get insurance if you can get insurance for this. The other thing it does is when people do bid on it, they raise their prices in knowing that they may have to defend this for some future litigation. So the end result is it creates somewhat of an unlevel playing field, it doesn't allow for accountability, and it costs the taxpayers dollars. And so I agreed to bring this legislation forward to basically remove this from, I think, about 5% of the building contracts in the state. DOT does not require this. Most of the contracts in the state don't. But those few that do are costing the state extra money. And I don't know if we can put a handle on that. There will be people to testify to that. And not only that, but it costs time and effort of the engineering firms and design firms that are involved in this. Basically, what we've done with this bill is we've taken the language of the Department of Transportation, who does about 95% of the business of construction in this state, and we've applied it across the board to all departments. I will tell you that there may be an unintended consequence of this bill that was called to my attention late last evening that may bring in some financial consultants for the Permanent Fund Dividend Group and the ARM Board, and that is not the intention of this legislation. And what I've agreed to do with them is once they get their attorneys on it and start looking at it, that I will clean that language up, because that is not the intention of this legislation. It is for the engineers, designers, more in the construction trade, to level that playing field for all those involved.
Okay. And I have an amendment here, Amanda, C.1, dated 316. Would you care to speak to that amendment, and somebody can offer it if it's the wish of the committee?
You know what? You caught me off guard, because I don't. Do I have an amendment?
Yes, you do.
X has an amendment.
Oh, absolutely.
Well, we do, but it's. Oh,
okay. It's sure. No, I have it. It's under my tab amendments, which would be the most difficult place for me to find it.
Believe me, I can relate.
Yeah, we do have online, and this was at the recommendation, I think, of legal to kind of clarify the language. We do have, I think, Terry Bannister is online, who can answer the questions. We wanted to work with everyone involved to make sure that this was as clean as we could, and I think this is kind of a cleanup, and so I would like to address that to Ms. Bannister, if she's online.
Well, I'd ask you, I'll move the amendment for discussion purposes.
I'll object so that we can hear it, Mr. Chairman.
Right, thank you. And that'd be amendment number one. And Ms. Bannister, are you online?
Yes, I am.
Would you tell us about this amendment, please?
It basically adds the provision of defense, an obligation of defense to what is in the bill. The bill talks about indemnification and hold harmless provision, and they add defense, and that would cover all the, you know, when you're going to court, defending the person in court. That type of thing. So it has a lot of parts to it, but that was what it was intended to do.
Thank you. Any questions for Ms. Bannister? If not, I would you care to remove the objection to the amendment?
Mr. Chairman, I'll remove it at this point.
Okay.
Just for the purpose of discussion, may I ask a question?
Okay, but he's already moved the objection, but go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the members of the committee who don't have legal experience in this area,
we're getting it fast.
Would you, Ms. Bannister, define some of these terms? What the difference between indemnification, defense, and hold harmless, so that people know what we're talking about here?
Ms. Bannister?
You know, I don't think I could tell you the difference between indemnify and hold harmless. Defense is clear. It's kind of been I could look that up and get back to you, but they've always been associated together. You would have all three, so there must be some specific difference between the two.
But defense is the obligation to defend against the claim.
Yeah, that's an important one. That's
indemnify is to bring back the original position, right?
I think so. I don't know the difference between indemnification and hold harmless. And
Mr. Chairman, I've also been handed a note by my most capable staff, who probably should be presenting this bill, obviously, that Brad Thompson with Risk Management suggested this, and he is in the audience. So if we could maybe ask him to come up.
If necessary, but we run short. We've already had the objection removed rather than...
Representative, and Mr. Chairman, I think that it's right to have it in there, but I think it's also equally right to have it explained. And so, you know, the amendment stands at this point. The objection has been removed. But I think it's worthy of explanation. Just be aware that it does go to a Judiciary Committee, and we will thoroughly vet these particular issues. I can see to that, and I'm sure the member to my right here will see to it.
So with that, in the interest of time, Amendment number one passes to the committee. Okay, now, Representative Johnson, any further comment?
Mr. Chairman, I think that I do have a definition here if you're interested, and I can pass it out to the difference between hold harmless and indemnification.
Fine, thanks.
In a professional services, I'll make that available to the staff. I think what this committee, as a State Affairs Committee, should look at is the policy of fairness that this does, that it looks at the cost to the state. Although this is not the Finance Committee, this does not have a finance referral, but the difficulty for private individuals to contract with the state, and look at that bigger policy decision. And as Representative Coghill said, that a lot of the language that is more of the legalese will be in the judiciary. I've also agreed to work with the Arm Board and the other entities that may in fact be affected by this to clean up that language so that the intent is clear that the bill lives up to the intent of the sponsor.
Right. Representative Coghill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And with the defense provision in there, we do take on a new dimension. But with the language that's in the bill, maybe the bill sponsor could help me. Has there been court tests of this particular language through the DOT, as you said, that it uses this language and uses it quite frequently?
Mr. Chairman, I do think we have someone from DOT on the line who might, Mark O'Brien, I mean, actually in the room, that could better answer that question.
I think it's a matter of policy. How that it's actually been played out practically would be helpful for us to understand as far as a policy call goes.
Fine. Somebody in the room who could answer that? Morning, sir.
For the record, my name is Mark O'Brien. I'm the Chief Contracts Officer for the Department of Transportation. And while the language of this is somewhat different than the indemnity and hold harmless provision that we've had since I've been involved with it, this goes back as far as 1992, I believe the language has basically been unchanged. The result has been that we've found this language to be adequate in protecting our concerns and have not had any specific claims or difficulties that would have required any amendment to that language.
Any other questions? Representative Rosas.
Sir, have you found some instances where there may have been contractors that would have bid on this that didn't because of the barriers that have been referenced by the sponsor?
Through the chair. In this case, the existing language that the department is under is the model in which this bill intends to move other entities toward. So ours, we would not have experienced that bar because we don't have the provisions that would have required a higher level of indemnification and defense from those primarily design firms.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Coghill?
I suppose the point of my question was, has anybody pierced this with regard to your liability in court?
Through the chair, before this bill was introduced, I was asked to take a look at it, and I contacted both the risk management section and the Department of Law, the transportation section attorneys that represent us. And they were not aware of any problems that they had in the recent past involving our current provision, which is the model that this is intended to move toward.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Coghill.
The public facilities that you manage are pretty significant. Maybe the sponsor of the bill should answer this, but with your experience in this, it must be a fairly decent range of public facilities that you manage under these contracts.
Through the chair, yes. The Department of Transportation is responsible for numerous buildings, facilities, highways, airports throughout the state. So it's fair to characterize a fairly significant investment in those facilities, yes.
And maybe, Mr. Chairman, for the chairman, you said, what was the percentage that the public facilities out of DOT manage compared to other public buildings?
Through the chair, my understanding is about 90% of the public. I mean, the court system bills some, the railroad does some, the university does some, but probably 90% of the construction is through Department of Transportation.
And Mr. Chairman, just in your experience then, Representative, do you know why this has not been added? Is it because of unique designs? Is it because of different focuses in the department? Can you tell me why this has not been previously a part of contracting?
Through the chair, I actually can't tell you why it hasn't been in the past. I know that it has been a battle that has been fought through design and engineering firms for quite a number of years. My guess is the reason it hasn't been brought to light is the fact that they weren't able to sit down with someone and maybe draw the picture and explain it, the inequities that exist in some of the contracting, to a legislator that would introduce the legislation, is my guess as to why it's not been brought forward until now.
And Ms.
Representative Cargill?
Maybe to DOT, who's had to probably communicate with different agencies outside of DOT, has there been a discussion on this very issue, looking for legal help from other agencies?
Through the chair, no. We haven't had any direct contact from other entities who may have some concerns with the indemnity. Each owner sets up their own contractual requirements for how they're going to impose the indemnity and hold harmless provisions on the contractors that work for them. And so they would do that in-house with advice of their own counsel and have not come to DOT and asked us that particular question that I'm aware of.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chairman, we do have in the room also Brad Thompson, who's the Director of Risk Management for the Department of Administration, who may have been more of a clearinghouse as opposed to the Department of Transportation. That might have been some, he might have had those questions asked. I don't know the answer.
And I'll yield to Representative Roses, but I would like to hear that if we have a couple
of
minutes.
Yeah, but as we're getting close to the end of our time here, is there anybody in the audience who, from out of town perhaps, who wants to testify on this before we have to shut the committee down? So to accommodate, anybody from out of town who came down here to testify on this bill? If not, Representative Roses?
this was a question for the individual from the Department of Transportation. caught me in the middle of putting his autograph down, so.
I was just making room for others to come up and.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that. We need the records to be clear, so thank you. In the facilities that the Department of Transportation manages, does that include the university systems buildings?
Through the chair, no, it does not. The university has their own contracting arm and handles those issues directly.
Thank you. I just wanted that on the record because I think this bill may have stemmed from the university system, and I think it has to do with the fact that one of the contractors that has been involved with the university for years on a number of their buildings and building designs is the one that brought this forward, simply because I think the indication was that they were no longer going to be bidding on those projects simply because they could no longer bear the responsibility of being potentially the sole source person that would go back on if there were any claims. And so I just wanted it clearly on the record that this protection that the Department of Transportation has in their way of doing it, that this bill would also provide that same security through the university if in any of the pursuits that they had in their construction. So,
thank you. Representative Dahl?
Yes, an effective date.
Again, please?
An effective date. I'm looking for I'm probably missing it and seeing it right here, but not.
There is none. That means it's effective, through the chair, that means it's effective 90 days after the governor signs it.
I see, thank you.
Representative Grunberg?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. There is a statute that I'm having duplicated and distributed that may have some interest to the committee. AS 4545-900 says indemnification agreements against public policy. And it basically says in certain types of construction contracts, clauses, well, if I may just read this very briefly. A provision, clause, covenant, or agreement contained in collateral to or affecting a construction contract that purports to indemnify the promisee against liability for damages for death or, one, death or bodily injury for, to persons, two, injury to property, three, design defects, or four, other loss, damage, or expense arising under 1, 2, or 3 of this section from the sole negligence or willful misconduct of the promisee or the promisee's agents, servants, or independent contractors who are directly responsible to the promisee is against public policy and is void and unenforceable. However, this provision doesn't affect the validity of an insurance contract, workers' comp, or agreement issued by an insurer subject to the provisions of AS 21, or a provision, clause, covenant, or agreement of indemnification respecting the handling, containment, or cleanup of oil or hazardous substance as defined in AS 46. And my question, and your name again, your name, sir?
Mark O'Brien.
To Mr. O'Brien through the chair, is does that provision apply to the state?
In this case, I would have to defer to, I believe there's a representative from the Attorney General's office online that can answer, or perhaps Brad Thompson, or both, but it's not in my area of expertise to answer that question.
Thank you. When they testify, I'd ask that they answer.
And I'm wondering, let's try to go to, oh, you don't want to testify, Brad Thompson, any comment to that? We're going to have to close down the committee here. Please identify yourself.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Brad Thompson, Director, Division of Risk Management. Risk Management provides the self-insurance, administers the self-insurance program for the state agencies, not the university, not the railroad, not AHFC, and or other school districts, local municipals. This bill defines public agencies to encompass all of those other parties to follow the form that the state has already been using. Risk Management advises and gives guidance to DOT and other state departments that we have in our self-insured program, and we use various forms of boilerplate conditions for indemnity in contracts for professional services, construction, and lease, whatever. It's a normal business practice. This bill proposes to apply the state's present business practice to all other public agencies as defined. So this, I submitted a fiscal note that shows that basically this is using our language, including the word and defend as amended. And so this is our practice and has been for some time. Representative Grunberg asked the question about AS 4545-900. That certainly would apply to the state. But the nuance there is that it limits the ability to contract out your sole negligence. You cannot contract away in a construction contract your own sole negligence. The state does not do so in its construction contracts, and it does not do so in the Appendix D, which is our professional form for design engineers.
Any questions?
Yes.
Representative Rogers.
So to make sure that I understand this, that there's a guarantee then in this that we're not indemnifying or holding harmless the negligence of the individual and the services he provides, but we're also, with this bill, protecting them from someone else's negligence, since they may be the party with the deepest pockets or may still be in business if somebody else has gone out of business. Is that a fairly accurate assessment?
Let me try to rephrase that through the chair.
Thank you.
In our contracts, we stipulate that the independent professional is responsible for their own deeds or misdeeds. And there's different words for it, but that's really what we're asking them to hold us and protect us from things that are their legal responsibility and to defend us in the cases where it is arising from their legal. But we, at the same time, say within that same clause, if there's comparative fault, if we and they are responsible for whatever occurred, we would apportion that based on comparative fault, which is prevailing law. Now, there are other ways of stronger stipulations of indemnity that would obligate the independent professional to also protect for the comparative allocation of the principal, the owner of the project. We don't do so.
If I may follow up, and that's
followed, then we're going to have to close it out.
That's, I appreciate that, and that's currently under the way that the state operates. But you said currently the university system, the railroad, and some of the other entities don't have that. This bill would provide that same level of coverage that you're referring to.
To be responsive, I don't administer the risk management guidance to those agencies,
I understand.
So I don't know the particulars. But I'm understanding that they have different terms.
Thank you.
Mr. Representative Johnson?
That is the intent.
I thank you.
Okay, thank you. I have several other people who are here to testify and answer questions. Unfortunately, we're out of time with the committee this morning, so I'm going to hold this bill. And our next meeting is Thursday, March 22nd, and we can hear bills that previously heard. On the schedule is HB 171, accommodating a 9-day session. As I understand it, you've had some contact, Representative Coghill, with Representative Seaton about the 30-day situation. Could you just give us about 15-second update on that?
Yes, sir, Mr. Chairman. We'll have a legal opinion brought to the committee and dealing with both initiatives and the proposed amendment will come before the committee on taking a 30-day break. There will be both practical and legal considerations.
And so it may be possible, from what you understand at this point.
Yes.
Okay. And we have also HB 184, commemorative troops license plate. That's pending referral. Whose bill was that? That's your bill? Are we going to have that in time?
I certainly hope that you don't have it while I'm gone.
Well,
but also don't want it to be get buried under the other stuff either. So if it does come up, I'm not here. I have very capable staff that will be more than willing to present that bill on my behalf, and they may actually do a better job than I would.
Okay, no comment.
Thank you for that.
And HB 13 is going to be a heavy-duty bill. That's on retirement system liability. And then we do plan to meet on Saturday, the 24th. We'll probably have to continue with HB 13 and maybe pick up, depending where we go with that, pick up some of the other. And on Saturday, that's at 10 o'clock, I'm advised, on Saturday. So you get to sleep in a little bit longer. So with that, I'd like to thank everybody's participation. And state affairs is adjourned at 8:30.